because we don't, we're not dealing with legislation, this is an informational hearing, an overview about different agencies, we can get started. So, and I really, really always want to be respectful of those people who were here on time. Anyway, what we're going to do is hear from the Office of Private Health and Partnership from the time as soon as John gets through giving an announcement, and we expect you to be through by 1:45, so I'll have to tell people not to ask you so many questions with long answers. Because it's going to grill you a little later, Rocky.
I'm fine, Madam Chair.
And then the State Commission on Children and Families from 1:45 until 2:30. I would have to be excused to go to a Ways and Means meeting at 2 o'clock, but either Representative Boone or Senator Gordley will be chair instead. So, John.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have two things to hand out. You've already received the Office of Private Health Partnerships Agency overview booklets, and the two things that I want to hand out relate to the percentage of federal poverty level. Those new numbers were released yesterday. They were published in the Federal Register, and I have handouts, the first showing various percentages of federal poverty level for 2007, and the second off of the Oregon Center for Public Policy's website showing a comparison of poverty level, 2007 poverty level, with 2006 estimated median incomes in the Portland area. So I will hand those out. I usually keep those right in the front of my book so that when you all ask me, well, what is 200% of federal poverty level, I can answer that. So we'll pass that out, and that is it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Rocky, will you join us?
Thank you, sir.
And whomever else you have with you that you want to come in. Senator Morissette has some rotten eggs, but I told him don't toss them at you today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Office of Private Health Partnerships. And I will say this once at the beginning so I don't have to keep referring to this, but we used to be known as the Insurance Pool Governing Board.
That's right.
And we changed our name last session out of habit after 17 years. Occasionally, I still call it IPGB, but it is the Office of Private Health Partnerships now. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today. I should add on just a couple notes. First of all, I believe that Senator Bates, Senator Morissette, probably yourself, Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, could probably come down and do this presentation as well as me. I mean, some of these folks have heard this 30 times, so I apologize if I'm going to be at a high level and not get to some of the more technical issues that I'm sure some of those who have more experience with the programs would like to see us get to, but we do have some limited time.
Feel comfortable in knowing that everybody knows that this is just a high-level overview, and that when you come back for your agency, you know, budget and your performance measures, all the technical questions will be answered at that particular time. Today is to acquaint our new people with who you are, what you are about. But technical questions, please, committee, let's save those until they come to us the next time around.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to, before I start, kind of put a face on this program, if I may, for a minute. The last 12 months, our office, through four phone receptionists, have received 95,000 calls. That's four people fielding 95,000 calls. That does not include all those folks who call the second time that have a direct line that they can call to a particular worker or someone that we've hooked them up with, they can call direct. I'm talking about just through our front office. In addition to that, and I'll talk a little bit about this, we have a couple of other programs we operate. The SHEBA, the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program, where in Marion County alone in the last 12 months, we received 9,000 calls, and from statewide, about 17,000 calls came into our office. There's a common theme in almost every call we get. I'm a small business owner. How do I get health insurance? I have cancer. No one will insure me. What do I do? I can't afford health care. Can you help me pay for health care? I'm working. My employer doesn't provide it. I could go on and give you basically 95,000 different messages and cries for help that these folks give. But it's important when you talk about the Office of Private Health Partnerships. We're a small agency, but we get funneled to us some of the unbelievable stories and human traumas that people face on a day-to-day basis. And that really relates to our mission, and I'm going to try to follow this outline the best I can. Our mission is, again, the agency is small, but the mission is broad. It's to provide assistance to businesses and individuals in obtaining health insurance. People call us. What's an agent's number? Do you know some companies that we can talk to? What are the website addresses? Is there a clinic in my community that I can send some of my employees to where the dependents aren't covered? People call up basically to try to find access to health care coverage. Secondly, we provide, and our mission is to provide subsidies to low-income working Oregonians who, while they're working, they still can't afford premiums. And we call this the FIOP program, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And the third part of our mission is to provide information, training, and linkages to local and state resources for both families and employers who, again, are trying to navigate the difficult matrix of health insurance in our state. So it's a small agency, broad mission, with a lot of folks getting on the phone, walking into our one office, and trying to get help. Let me talk a little bit how we're organized. It's called the Office of Private Health Partnerships, again, formerly the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and we have basically four components and programs within the agency. The Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which again provides subsidies to low-income Oregonians. What we call information, education, and outreach, which I'll talk about a little bit when I get into some detail. Certified plans for small employers coming out of the 2003 session, where they asked us to put some plans out there that businesses that are uninsured might be interested in buying, and we did that with very limited success, but I want to talk about that in more detail later. And finally, and we put this in because it would impact our agency to a great deal in terms of the scope of its responsibility as well as the staff, the number of staff we have in our budget, and that is the governor's Healthy Kids proposal. We would be responsible for the private sector component of that. The agency was organized, or first started in 1987, and at the same time that the Insurance Pool Governing Board, or the office, was established, the legislature established what's called the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is a high-risk health insurance pool, kind of the last resort for many individuals throughout the state who have diabetes, multiple sclerosis, cancer, asthma, high blood pressure, heart disease, whatever it may be, and they can't get insured in the regular market. We are really the insurer of last resort. And when OMIP, is what it's called, and the Office of Private Health Partnerships were formed, one had staff, the other didn't, one had money, the other didn't. So they came together through an interagency agreement and said, let's administer this program together. We had two separate boards, but let's just have the same administrative staff. We've kept that relationship basically since 1990 when the first staff were hired by both the Office of Private Health Partnerships and OMIP. In 1993, OMIP became a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, so we're kind of split, but we still administer the program together. 2 years ago, transferred to our responsibility was the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program, and it's called SHIBA in this state, and that's a very small program within DCBS that's now kind of housed with us. We provide telephone assistance, recruitment of local volunteers, and training throughout the state around Medicare issues, and that's been critical for us because of the implementation of the prescription drug program, Medicare Part D. I talked about 95,000 calls coming in to four staff. They had fewer in that they had only about 8,000 to 10,000 from Marion County area and another 17,000 statewide. But we have two staff basically to man the phones on that, and those calls become much more complicated because you're dealing with people sometimes that are 70, 75, 80, 85 years old, and trying to help them navigate the Medicare market is extremely difficult. So we're kind of organized in this little group of different agencies, different programs, but we work pretty good together, and the common theme is that we're linked to the private sector. We're not just kind of a state program. We work with employers, we work with agents, we work with stakeholders in local communities. So we're really kind of bridging, I think, the public and private sector. So let me talk a little bit about FEOP, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. It was established by the legislature in 1997. It was a state-funded only program. It really came out, and if you recall back then, standard population in the Oregon Health Plan was above 100,000. We had the CHIP program, the regular Medicaid. There's a whole group of folks out there, though, that were out working who earned too much to qualify for one of the state programs, but they themselves were paying the taxes, you know, doing the voting. So an initiative came out of the legislature to start FEOP and to provide subsidies to people to purchase either group health insurance through their employer if it was offered, and if it wasn't offered, to have them have access to the individual market. In the index or the appendix in there, I have a list of program principles. I'm not going to go through each one of those, but it's kind of important to look at because every decision we make around FEOP in terms of how we operate, we try to tie back to those principles: self-reliance, choice, focus on children, making sure the children and the families are insured, paying attention to the fact that these folks are generally working. They can't come to meetings during the day. They're not accessible, like a lot of clients who are either disabled or at home, in terms of how we interact with them. So when we look at how we administer the program and what we do, we always try to refer back to those principles. The program operated at very low levels. I think we had a maximum of 7,500 immediately. Budget cuts brought it down to, I want to say, under 2,000 at one point. It just kind of was at the whim of where we were on state dollars. But in 2001, the legislature passed what's called Oregon Health Plan 2, which really developed or focused on an expansion of both the Medicaid portion of the Oregon Health Plan, but also FEOP. And we were granted waivers by the Center on Medicaid and Medicare Services in 2002, and later that year began receiving federal funds and being able to leverage those state funds that we had so that we could expand our population. And we grew from in the low thousands up to above 10,000. Part of FEOP's history is up and down enrollment because we have, quite frankly, been a budget balancer for a variety of reasons. Most of those have to do with how do we fund and keep the Oregon Medicaid, the other portion of the Oregon Health Plan, going and sustainable also. But that has been a challenge I'll talk about in a few minutes. Our target audience is those individuals and families that earn under 185% of the federal poverty level, which is about, in 2006 figures, I'm sorry, John, I don't have the 2007, is about $3,100 per month for a family of four. We serve both parents and children and single adults, and there are some dependent adults. If you have someone, for example, that's very disabled that you're taking care of, even if they're an adult and you're an adult, they can be included in the family. But it's primarily parents and children and single adults. We serve both the group and individual market. Currently, we have about 14,000, a little over 14,000 enrolled in the program. About 5,800 of those are in the group market, and about 8,300 of those are in the individual market. The focus was always to try to do the best we could on the group side, because that's where we can leverage our most dollars. The cost for providing group coverage in FEOP is about half of that of individual coverage. The problem, of course, is more and more employers are failing to offer dependent coverage or dropping their contributions down to the levels that it's very difficult for families to afford it. So group coverage has always been a challenge to us. We'd hope to be at a more of a 50-50 split. We continue to try to get group. It's always going to be difficult. A couple points. In group coverage, about 45% of those enrolled are children. So we do have a lot of kids accessing the program on the group side, where the individual market, about 20% of those are children. What happens to the other kids on the individual market? They go to Medicaid CHIP program, where there's no premiums and generally a better benefit than they're going to get in the commercial market. We view that as very positive, and through our counseling with folks, make sure that they have information on both the private sector and the public sector program. Also, in that 8,400 folks that are in the individual market, about 3,500 of those are people with very serious chronic health conditions. Generally, the average age is 50 for that 3,500. About 70% are female. And these are folks that are using the FEOP subsidy really to get into the high-risk pool. That's their only option. We find about 40% of those that don't have group coverage available that are on our waiting lists or come into our program have serious health conditions that need some sort of attention now rather than down the road. And so they end up in OMIP because no one's going to insure them with their multiple sclerosis, their cancer, their high blood pressure. In addition to the 14,000 we serve, we have about 21,000 that are either on a waiting list, they've been sent applications, or that we have applications under review in order to keep, as people move out of the program, we try to maintain our enrollment levels. So we have quite a backlog of folks that I think would like to have access to this program. One of the key principles and key things about this program is it's not an entitlement. It is budget-driven. So you give us $22 million or $80 million or $100 million, we manage to that amount, and we close new applications when we project that we're going to expend that. So it isn't an open end that everybody can come in, and that's why we have waiting lists as high as 30,000 at some times. Sometimes it's 25,000. Now it's getting down there because we're trying to bring in some additional folks to take care of some of the attrition we've had. Our responsibilities are pretty easy. Eligibility, enrollment, subsidy payments, certifying the plans that they're eligible to enroll in, doing what we call a review of the benefits to ensure that they meet the federal benchmarks that we can subsidize and use those federal dollars. We also do marketing outreach and education around the program with agents, stakeholders, Department of Human Service staff, local health clinics, a variety of folks that we try to do outreach on. We have about 49.5 FTE in the governor's budget for this staff. It has really two sources of funds, or three sources of funds that you'll hear about, general fund and other funds. And the other funds include both federal funds and a very small, limited amount of tobacco tax dollars. And I'll talk about that when we talk about healthy kids. So $23.4 million in general fund, $50.9 million in other funds. That's kind of
Rocky, just a moment, please.
Just a point of clarification. When Mr. King talks about federal funds, the reason that they are booked as other funds is they are coming from DHS.
Mm-hmm. The federal funds flowing to them, and then they flow to us as we expend those dollars.
Thanks.
The Information Education Outreach, what we call IEO program, really came about in 1993 when the legislature said we need to put some marketing money and some outreach money with then the IPGB so we can start going out into local communities and telling them about some of the state programs, some of the programs that we were operating. And we basically target licensed health insurance producers, or what we call agents, associations, and carriers. partners, different advocacy groups and other stakeholders, state and local government agencies, whether it's schools, again, clinics, small business owners, self-employed employers. We meet with a lot of the HR organizations of the larger employers to talk about some of the state alternatives. And we also have meetings where we meet with uninsured Oregonians, and some of our programs we meet with some of our clients, some of those that are enrolled, or annually we'll go out or every 3 or 4 years in different communities and let them meet with us to tell us how we're doing. The key components of that are agent referrals. Last year I think we did, and I have the figures here, I think over something like 4,600 agent referrals. So a lot of the people call in, they need help. It's not necessarily a program, but somebody in their local community that they can go talk to help them get into health insurance. We made over 4,600 agent referrals last year. People get onto our referral program basically through a certification process by attending our training sessions, agreeing to be willing to assist people not only on those things where they make a commission, but also those things where they don't make a commission. That is, link them to CHIP, link them to OMIP, and if they agree to that, then they're a part of our agent referral program. It's absolutely worked well. I have to give a lot of kudos to hundreds of agents out there that have worked with us over the years in helping find slots for these people to kind of fit into and hopefully get the kind of access to health care or health care insurance they need. We do continuing education programs where we actually give what's called CE credits to agents who must continually be updated, and our training again is around most state programs relating to health care, whether that's the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, the CHIP program, Medicaid, SHEBA, the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance Program, FEOP, or whatever that may be. We do a lot of stakeholder training. You want to make sure that the social side or the public side also knows what the private side is doing, so we try to bridge that so that everybody has the tools, public or private. And finally, we just provide general insurance information. Audience, very simple, insurance agents, associations, advocacy groups, the local agencies, kind of the same folks, again, that I mentioned above. Funding sources, there's not a lot of money here. There's two FTE. We have about $462,000 general fund and $128,000 or so of other funds, and that's miscellaneous revenues we get in from training or whatever it may be that we're able to expand for our marketing efforts. Again, we have two FTE to do that. Third component of our agency is called the Certified Plans for Small Businesses. And we'll talk about this a little bit because there's a decision that the legislature really doesn't have to make, but it's set to, some of our responsibilities are set to sunset this year, and we have no plans at this time to move forward to ask that those be extended, but are willing to sit down with legislators individually or collectively to talk about some of our experience. But let me give some history. 1987, legislature passed a bill that said, established the Insurance Bill Governing Board, now the office, that said, develop some really low-cost, neat plans for small businesses that have been uninsured for a period of 2 years. And by the way, and they did this through a formula, we want those to cost $53.33. And that's by saying no business had to pay more than 40, and no employee had to pay more than 25 bucks. And when you do the math, it comes out to $53.33. There was a volunteer board in 1987. Took them a couple of years. In 1989, they came out with these plans, working with people like Regents and Kaiser and HealthNet and some of the carriers. I will tell you, in 1989, for $53.33, you could buy something. You could buy a $500 deductible plan through PACC or Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, and if you were in good health in those days, because they looked at the health of the group and the age of the group, you could buy a $200 deductible plan from Blue Cross Blue Shield. Well, they started off slow because there was no money in the budget, no staff. Board just kind of seeing, you could see the Xerox brochures. It was really funny that when I first started with the agency in 90 that they were using. And it continued just to kind of a couple thousand folks enrolled. The legislature said, here's 300,000, go market this thing. We saw that enrollment over the next 3 years, and working with the carriers and the agent community, ads and newspapers, brochures, and we really got two staff to go out and start doing this, and we saw it grow to over 33,000 people enrolled by 1996, in almost a three and a half year period. Benefits were still pretty good because inflation at that point in medical side was zero. We had the managed care, what we used to call the Hillary Clinton effect, when they were talking about really looking at turning a healthcare system upside down, that kind of had some impact on some of the rates, the managed care phenomenon that kept rates down. So we had a lot of folks coming in and things were going pretty good. In the legislature in 1996, really stepped ahead of the federal government and did some tremendous reforms to the insurance industry, basically providing guaranteed issue to any group in the state of Oregon that wanted to purchase health insurance, meaning any group less than 50 employees. And prior to that, they could be turned down for coverage they applied for. In 93, you had set one plan up that they could go to, but it wasn't a very good plan and people really didn't buy it. But 96, you stepped out and really said, hey, let's serve everybody and give everybody an opportunity that has group coverage to come in. That changed the dynamics of the insurance pool governing board products, the certified plan products, because now people had access to everything that was out there in the market if they were a small business. So we started to see our enrollments decline. And one of the other reasons was that we were community rated. Whether you were 60 or whether you were 30, you paid $53.53 for a plan. Well, the regular market is age rated. And so what you started seeing was the young folks leaving our plans and going to the regular market, leaving us with a large number of the older folks. So the losses started pumping up so that by 1997-98, you started seeing for that same $53.33, which did get indexed a little bit, was up in the $60. But you started seeing people look at $2,500 deductible plans, $3,000 deductible plans. So we came to the legislature in 1999 and said, let's close the program. The market's working well. Inflation is doing good. Businesses are providing coverage. Our enrollments are going down. It's a different era than it was in the late 80s. And the legislature agreed and we closed it. And then it just kind of blew up. 20-30% increases starting at around 2000 for businesses every year. Businesses started dropping coverage, raising deductibles and co-pays because of the struggle that you are going to be talking about throughout this this session around some of the dynamics of the healthcare the problem today. So some folks in the legislature, some legislators said, hey, let's you know, we're pretty successful with the certified plans back in the early 90s. Let's resurrect them. So they resurrected them, directed us to go out there and do good work again. A couple problems. First of all, they didn't tell us what the price ought to be. They just said, come up with some low-cost options. Well, I'll be very frank. When I have a legislator who says, I want a plan with no mandates, but by the way, except for diabetic education, and then I go meet with another legislator who says, come up with a cheap plan, no mandates, but by the way, be sure women's health is in there. By the time we got done with all the legislative input and all the advocates, we had a plan that really was only 10 to 15% cheaper than what was in the regular market. That was not enough to attract any enrollment whatsoever. You can count under 100 the number of enrollments that we had in that year. Secondly, and kind of to some degree the same mistake we made in 1987-89, is there was no marketing. Absolutely $0 for marketing. So we, again, were kind of having to get onto the backs of some of our other programs, but we really weren't out being able to go out there and do anything other than do a brochure and send a brochure out to some folks. Now, a couple good things came out of this. First of all, a focus on kids. One of the things that we did say was we're not going to give a $3,000 deductible plan to a child. So we did design a children's plan that employers could buy, separate from covering the employee or the employee's spouse. The problem we ran into there is that employers are concerned about their employees. they're really, I'm not going to say, I don't want to be like they don't care about the dependents and the employees' children, but the reality is when they have to put their dollars on the table, they don't have enough dollars to start covering the dependents and children, or just the children. So we saw very, very little little interest in the children's plan. And because the benefits were so high, they included all the mandates, had all the preventative benefits, pretty good co-pays and deductibles. They were expensive. In fact, the child's plan was just as expensive in the $160 up to $200 range, depending on the age, as one of the adults' plan was. So our decision at this point is we've learned some lessons. One of those lessons is it's not the mandates that drives costs. You can take out the mandates. It's very nice to say, let's pull out mental health. That's 4% or 3% or 2%. But when you're looking at 10, 15, 20% gains per year, pulling out one benefit gives you just 1 year of relief and a very small relief. Secondly, is employers that aren't insured today, as well as employers that are not worried about today's costs. What they're worried about is tomorrow's cost. If I buy today at $200, in a becomes an expectation of my business that I provide this, and you come in next year, same benefit plan, and say it's $260 with a 30% increase. I can pay $200 now, but I'm not going to pay $230 next time or $260. So employers really talk to us about not today's cost, but about tomorrow's cost. The other thing is that there are options in the market. If you want to buy a $20,000 deductible plan and pay $100 a month, you can do that. The plans out there, both low cost as well as high cost, are that the problem with the low cost plans is you get what you pay for. If you want to buy a new car for $8,000, you can do that. But if you want to have one that has a steering wheel, you got to pay $9. And that's what we run into with some of these certified plans. So, no funding was appropriated. Our sense is, unless there are legislators that want to sit down and talk to us, I believe the governor's position at this point is we'll allow it to sunset. Then I want to talk about the Healthy Kids Program. I only have a few minutes. I'm just going to touch on it briefly. That's House Bill 2201 and Senate Bill 31 in collaboration with the Department of Human Services. It's one of the governor's top priorities. It's many of the legislators' top priorities. Is in today's era of high uninsurance rates in Oregon, the least we can do is focus on trying to get 117,000 kids over the next 2 to 3 years insured between the public and private sectors. The Office of Private Health Partnerships would play a big role in that we would take the component above 200% of poverty level for those families that would serve those in the private sector, meaning the commercial licensed market.
So, Rocky, will you have a marketing, you will develop a marketing strategy for that? And the reason I'm asking you that, because I referred a couple of constituents to you, you did a good job with them, but how would they have known about the program except you or I, who come in close contact with somebody who knows me, and that might be good for other members of the committee, because I'm sure that there are a lot of consumers out there without medical health, and a lot of people don't know about, you know, the Office of Private Health Insurance Assistance Program.
I'm not sure that's a question.
Okay, so my question is, how will you develop a strategy
for the healthy kids?
For healthy kids going out to the community, or who will be in charge of that?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, and when we get into detail of the budget, I'll go through this, but very briefly, we have about $11 million for administration of our portion of the Healthy Kids Program in the governor's budget. And I don't know what we're all going to end up with. That'll be the decision you make. But out of that $11 million, about $5.6 million of that is for marketing, outreach, education, whatever you call it, related to the Healthy Kids Program. And of that $5.6 million, I'll look at Becky to make sure I'm right, about $3.5 million of that is directed to really local communities.
You're saying you're right.
$3 million in grants. to local communities, and we're not sure how to divide the, how the regions are going to be. That's part of the planning process we'll do. We have some what we call referral fees, where we can pay people that go out and refer people to us and help them enroll in our in the Healthy Kids, whether that's our program or the public sector side, the Medicaid side. And then there's a small amount of money, about $200,000 of that 3.5, that's for targeted to specific pockets or areas where we know we've got to do more than just a regular marketing information and outreach. And whether you're talking about some of the high insurance rates in the Woodburn area, in the Hispanic community, for example, or if we're talking about some of the areas in Eastern Oregon. So that's a very big component. In the office, we'll be taking responsibility, again, if approved, we just have a proposal on the table, for doing the outreach and marketing for all of Healthy Kids, not just the private sector component. So our responsibility isn't just to get 15,000, 16,000 people in the commercial side. It'll be to get 20,000, I'm not sure what first one is, 20,000 or 25,000 into also the public sector side. Does that kind of get you?
Yes, thank you.
So you'll hear a lot during the budget period about the Healthy Kids program, and you're probably members of a variety of committees that will be looking at that. It's going to be a good policy debate, discussion on the part of this legislature, but I want you to know that we're behind this proposal 100%, simply because so many of the calls we get, that 95,000 calls, are people trying to find things for their children, not just for themselves. The funding on that is proposed to be tobacco tax and federal funds. Again, that'll be a legislative debate and decision, and we're obviously hopeful that we'll come to some agreement and solution on how to get coverage to these kids. Talk briefly about agency performance measures. We have four, really, that we're going forward with. A number of stakeholders trained. In 2005, it was about 3,800. Our target was 1,000. Number of FEOP enrollees that we would serve in a given year, not at one time, but during the year. Our target was 15,800 for 2006. We served about 22,000. Our customer satisfaction surveys that we do, and there are five pieces to it, but overall we had an objective of a 90% satisfaction with our customer service. We achieved a 95.5% satisfaction. We're pretty happy with that. And on FEOP administrative costs, Senator Bates was here because he was a part of this targeting. We targeted basically 9% by the end of the biennium. In 2005, the target was 10%. We were at 9.9%. And the target in 2006 was 9%. And we're running a little high. We're at 9.9% for 2006. So we're down a little bit, not a little bit, but it was an arbitrary. Let's just cut it to 10% or 9% from the 10 we originally proposed, and we're doing our best to get there. We had some other.
What causes the fluctuation in cost going up and down? What causes that administratively?
Madam Chair, what causes it, if the more people you put in a group, your higher administrative cost, because you're dealing with a much more complex system. If all of a sudden you come down, for example, in enrollment, you don't just fire staff because you're down 1,000 folks. We have a challenge that I'll just mention briefly. It's a good news, bad news kind of thing in OMIP, or in FEOP. Blue Cross Blue Shield cut their individual market rates by 14% effective January 1. About a third of our people are in Blue Cross Blue Shield. If you look at OMIP, the high risk pool, where we have 3,400 people, they cut their rates January 1, which I'm a part of, so I know that, by about 12 to 13% because our rates are based on the commercial market. So blue rates come down, our rates come down. Mm-hmm. In all of our budget models, we projected a 7 to 10% increase. So all of a sudden, our average cost for our enrollees dropped considerably beginning January 1. Our work didn't change, but our expenditures changed. One of the things that we've been looking at is the cost per enrollee as opposed to cost against the expenditures of subsidies. That is on target where we want it to be, but the cost of our people in our program has actually come down over the last 3 to 4 months because of what's happened in the commercial market. Major challenges and issues, almost on here, predictable and sustainable funding for FEOP. When you open and close, and you open and close, and you open and close, we still have people out there that think the group market's closed. You go up to 15,000, down to 7. It is very difficult to keep a consistent message in the communities, whether we're open or closed, and people deciding to come in and out. That's just the nature of FEOP. I'm not suggesting anything other than that's one of our challenges that we always have to deal with. The enrollment employer-based coverage, we continue to keep that open, to go after it the best we can, but it's a challenge when you see the number of employers offering coverage for dependents and their children, or spouses and children of their employees. If they drop it, it's difficult for us to come in the door. The Deficit Reduction Act, you know about that, I assume. Any federal funds coming into a program, Medicaid funds, people have to prove their citizenship. They have to provide you with a copy of their, not a copy, the original birth certificate, and other identification to prove that they're U.S. citizens. I'll just give you one fact. Pen rate on applications and redeterminations was 30% a year ago. The act comes into place. Nothing else has changed. Our pen rate is 70%. If you live in California and you don't have a copy of a birth certificate, it takes you 4 to 5 months to get one.
We just I want to tell the committee this. Our office just helped a person, American citizen, to get their birth certificate. They were not born in Oregon. It is now taking them 8 weeks from another state to get their birth certificate. So let me encourage all of you that in case that were not born in Oregon, you might think, well, why would I need it? Well, you're going to start using passports and all this other kind of stuff to do anything. So if you were born in the United States, you might want to do that. Rocky, I know you want to finish.
Madam Chair,
yes, sir.
I'm just a request for information. The two plans, business plans in 04 implemented in 05, you said they weren't really used for small businesses. Could you give me more information about those two plans and why they weren't successful?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Merced, would you like me to do that offline or do that now?
No, not now.
Okay.
No,
I'll set up with you and get you that information.
Vicki is throwing darts and arrows with her eyes at me right now saying, get off her time.
One last thing. Every program I've talked about, this is a training manual we do for stakeholders and agents. All you have to do is let the community administrator know. We've got a few copies here. We will deliver them to your office so that you don't have to carry them around. But every brochure, every application, every program description is in there, including all the statutes. So if you just let them know, we'll get them to you, and they're a good resource.
Representative Bloom said it's a teeny thing, and I just wonder if it's ever been considered. And that is people who try to get in private insurance, you know, through individual or group, through whatever, are being denied if they, you know, and I have personal experience with this, so I know what I'm talking about, or they get the coverage not with a pre-existing, whatever, is a seizure disorder. It's very cheap condition to manage, but what you do when you don't put them, you don't offer them the coverage and they can't pay for their medication, then you end up with high cost, you know, high risk care in the emergency departments. And why isn't something like that that's manageable at a low cost included in some of these coverages, whereas it's going to cost us a whole bunch more on this end if it's not?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, we can start. I don't think you want to take the time now, but I'd be happy to meet with you, and then also when we come back, talk a little bit about what goes on in the dynamics of the private sector market that impact those kinds of things. But I'll also set up some time where
another teeny question from Representative Kotak.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Rocky, for the presentation. I just have three items that I thought I'd let you know that I'd like to hear when you come back. Detailed information on your referral track. tracking your stats of the 95,000 calls? What do you refer them to? You know, I'm sure you have them. Details on the RFP process for the private plan and Healthy Kids. Maybe some discussion around that and how you're going to run through the criteria on that. And then details of the marketing plan on Healthy Kids. I'm curious whether you think there's enough money in there for sustained statewide outreach, not so much the local grants, but you know the 800 numbers. I'd like to see TV advertising. I'm just curious what you're budgeting for that. So, thank you.
Thank you. There's something I'd like to flag for a future discussion. You mentioned that with regard to the certified plans for small employers, that employers are worried about tomorrow's costs. I'm also worried about tomorrow's jobs. I've been hearing from a lot of people who have a tremendous amount of support for small business, which means this is our local business, these are our local employers. It's just a great support for this. This is the kind of business that is the economic engine for the state. I've talked to some small business owners who maybe are offering health insurance now, and by now, actually, since it's already 2007, they may have dropped it. They were concerned they were not going to be able to keep up with the escalating costs. Not only are there those who can't offer anything for their employees, but those who are now, by now, starting to drop plans. I'm very concerned this speaks to the competitiveness of local Oregon business. Can they even stay open? If they can't attract employees, are their employees going to be able to stay working for them if they no longer have health insurance? So I'm very concerned. Are we just saying that we have to turn our backs on this problem because we haven't figured out how to address it yet?
So you have your orders and you come back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I hope the committee will not mind staying an additional 7 minutes to give the commission their fair time. One last one, this end. Did you have something you wanted to come back with, Dr. Bates?
Yeah, only that the comments we just made are exactly on target, but it's more a problem of not what insurers do or don't do. It's a problem of how we deliver health care in this country.
Right.
We spend 50% more per person in this country than any other nation in the world. And our outcomes are rated about 30th. The problem really isn't the FIAP plan or Blue Cross or Blue Shield. It's how we deliver health care. And coming soon to you will be legislation that will be addressing that problem.
Senator Gordon, anything you want to come back with? The office member?
I'm just one of those.
Okay.
Carry on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You're welcome. I am going to have to leave at 2 for Ways and Means Committee meeting. And before I go, I would be remiss if I did not, and I know I'm preempting you a little bit, you have a new employee who happens to be a very well-respected former operations manager for Multnomah County, Ms. Iris Bell, who's on saying she and Senator Gordon and I share her as a constituent. And because she works the community over, she's a community activist and very much respected. So I want to welcome her to this legislative process, Ms. Bell, and give Nikki kudos for being able to look out there and find that level of talent before she can go anywhere. Because she knows she loves to live in South Africa, so I'm glad you caught her before she went there. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Nikki Lansing. I am the director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And I share your pleasure, in fact, much more so, Senator Carter, in being able to have Iris Bell come on staff. You know that old saying, you think you have died and gone to heaven?
Yes.
That may apply here. I, too, like Rocky King, come before you with a commission that has a very broad mandate, but is a very small agency and a small staff. The commission system has really the responsibility for partnering with both professional and citizens and local communities, engaging those communities, developing local comprehensive plans, looking at an early childhood system with a focus on that system, but also with a focus on a continuum of prevention efforts in each system that we have along that 0 to 18 continuum. We have several areas that we are responsible for. We have the work within just the commission system, and then we have work within partners that I'm going to describe to you more fully. We are organized with a state commission who develops policy, 36 local commissions who also develop policy, a state office that implements the policy of the legislative mandates and that the state commission has set. Their main legislative mandate is to set guidelines for the planning, coordination, and delivery of local services. The intent was to take as much of the resource we have at the state level, move it to the local level, have local people decide, make decisions based upon their own strengths, resources, gaps, etc., as to how they want to spend their dollars in terms of what brings the greatest result. The state commission, the policy body especially, is to advise the legislative assembly, you and the governor, and the local commissions advise their local boards of county commissioners.
Mickey, can you hold for a minute?
Mm-hmm.
This is a complicated agency because it connects with so many others, and if you have any questions in terms of clarity on this piece, feel free to ask those because it is a little complicated.
Thank you, Senator Carter, and Senator Carter, members of the committee. I know that Erin Kelly Seal did tell me that she drew a diagram for
she
you,
did.
Senator Carter.
That's right.
And you happen to be one of the legislators that has been here the longest who has heard us before.
That's right.
So when we come back for our Ways and Means hearing, we're hoping to have that diagram in a way that hopefully can simplify who we are.
Good.
So, we compile, analyze, and distribute information around what those 36 local plans have said. We provide a process for partners to develop that local plan. We focus on evidence-based and best practices, research-based strategies. All the dollars that come into the commission system are based upon research and evidence-based practice. We lead an effort to establish an early childhood system and develop policy around that. And we just as of last session got the juvenile crime prevention advisory work into the commission system. So now I'm just going to talk for a minute about this board because I think it does give you a bit of a picture of what we do, not only within our system, but how it affects other partners. So with the local level, you have what you call existing community supports all along the continuum. The commission's role is to look at with other people in the community what all these supports are and identify the strengths, gaps, barriers that exist in the community. The hope is if you're a healthy community, all of these supports exist along a continuum. The commission then takes those dollars that we call locally invested funds, where they have some ability to make decisions locally about those gaps and the strengths in their community, and they address certain issues, such as preventing child abuse. Healthy Start is a program of the commission that helps to do that. But there are other things, like Babies First Cocoon, other kinds of things that we do in the community.
Sure.
Yeah.
May I ask a quick question? The safety net group that exists in the local communities is under what bubble over there? That's to prevent child abuse.
That would be to prevent child abuse, Senator Morissette.
And that has a separate funding.
It has a separate funding, although some of the locally invested funds that local commissions have go towards supporting that effort.
Okay. Okay.
It's now called Family Support and Connections, but it is for those families who have been referred to the child welfare system. No case has been founded, but we want to have those resources within the community that we can refer those families to. So we take those dollars and look at, in all of these areas, where it is that we need to be a bridge to make something happen for those kids and families. We make sure that we engage citizens. One of the greatest things we do in terms of mobilizing communities is getting both the effort of local citizens and additional resources. In Klamath Falls, you've done a great job of developing your early childhood system. In Blaine and Multnomah counties, they've done a great job on addressing hunger. Multnomah County, I think the figure is they have increased feeding children
and their program for free and reduced lunches, like summer food programs, by 96%. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. I know in Tillamook County, your partnerships in terms of having limited resources, all of those people coming together, have made a huge difference in providing additional support for your community. In Jackson County, you have looked at your child abuse prevention efforts. And last session, we were able to fund an additional relief nursery to ensure that the children in Jackson County got those supports. So the intent always through those local plans and assessing the needs in the community is to see where we bring all of the dollars, not just the commission dollars, but where do we bring those dollars to support all of the jobs. Through the commission system, we have some targeted early prevention dollars. The universal part of Healthy Start is a part that's no longer paid with general funds, but volunteers do home visitations, welcome baby visits, we call. Healthy Start was always meant to be a home visitation program to prevent child abuse, and universal. Because of reduced funding last session, we had to go to a more targeted base of really working with those higher-risk families. So again, if we don't get them in this place, then we go down to what are the, how much can we do in terms of those intensive visits. Relief nurseries. Relief nurseries are, again, a system of dealing with children and their families. Most of them have already been in the child welfare system or are just at the very edge. And relief nurseries fit very well with Healthy Start, because Healthy Start, when they get those really, really high-risk families, need to have a place to refer those families to. Court appointed special advocates. Again, operating trained volunteers who operate in the best interest of that child who is in outcome placement. Juvenile crime prevention. Assuring, again, as you're further on the continuum, that you're keeping those kids from penetrating any further into that juvenile justice system. And then other targeted prevention services with the alcohol, drug, mental health, et cetera, for the community. What we know is if we don't have the supports here at that first level, kids and their families keep falling through the cracks. So it is much more cost effective to spend our dollars in this area rather than here, which is in fact the cost of those inadequate supports. So what we're trying to do is to ensure to the best of our ability that we maximize the use of all of our funds. Is that helpful to you?
Making the safety net program in Springfield started when Tessa McCall, a three-year-old, was murdered, and she was under the radar screen of services and children and families, and it should never, never, never have happened. And so something that safety net was instituted, which will save lives. It's at risk now in terms of funding and so on. But it's exactly as you say, if we don't catch them up here, there's tragedy down below. We may not catch them there yet.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome. When you come back, I would like to hear more about the faith and community organizations' support, what that looks like now statewide. I would also be interested in hearing your views on the Children's Mental Health Initiative that we passed in the last legislative session without funding, and your thoughts about where that fits and how we move forward with that initiative.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Gordon. We will do that. Just a brief history, and I'm just really going to focus on four particular areas. Community planning was first begun in 1979 with the Juvenile Services Act. A small amount of money went to local communities around juvenile justice issues in the hopes that those communities would leverage those dollars to provide additional support. What was true in 1981 when a recession hit the state of Oregon, and they were thinking, they being the state, that they were going to have to build a third training school
their hope was that those particular funds would, again, maximize and leverage other resources in the community so that would not occur. And in fact, it did not occur. So planning has a long history locally, planning locally and using those dollars locally of success. In 1989, our then governor was very concerned about the human services budget and what was happening and said, you know, government can't do it all. Government has a role to play, but we also, again, have to maximize the use of community resources. And so the second iteration of the commission system was the Oregon Community Children and Youth Services Commission, which expanded the role a bit in looking at the whole continuum, not just juvenile services, on how we could support kids and their families locally. The third iteration was in 1993, where we became the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Again, further expanding the role, trying to move dollars to the local level to best support communities. And then the last iteration was in 1999, Senate Bill 555, that was a juvenile crime prevention bill, but clarified the role of the commission system in being the facilitator and the developer of the plan locally, bringing all of those people together, and the state commission office at the state level bringing other agencies together, primarily Oregon Youth Authority, Oregon Department of Education, Department of Human Services, the Juvenile Crime Prevention, and us, in order to look at how we really coordinated services to reduce duplication, fragmentation, but in the end have a better support system for all kids and their families. So, how are we organized at the state level to do this? And this is just in your packet. I'm not going to go over every piece. You see operations, policy development and promotion, accountability, programs and initiatives, plan development and implementation, and resource development. Operations is a foundational piece of anything. The five areas we concentrate on are, first, the policy development and promotion. That's the area of supporting the state commission, bringing commission issues just within our own system to that group, but also the other issues of those 36 local coordinated plans. The state commission's real role is to inform, advise, educate, and then advocate for what 36 local communities say are their greatest needs and concerns in this state. And there's a whole host of areas, as you can see, that are part of that, and I'm going to get into that in a minute. Accountability. We started in the commission system, building an accountability system in 1997, when we hired researchers from Oregon State University to develop what we called our building results plan. We trained every county, 36 local commissions, and how is it that we know we are being successful in supporting kids and their families locally? Our programs and initiatives. We have programs that are specific, concrete programs like Healthy Start, Relief Nurseries, court-appointed special advocates, and then the commission leads efforts around particular interagency initiatives like homeless and runaway, community schools, positive youth development, etc. So, and at the basis of everything we do is that issue of cultural competency. When the first local plans were due after Senate Bill 555, the first local plans were due in 2002, 26 out of the 36 plans could not be approved. The reason why is because they had not addressed the issues of cultural and ethnic diversity in their communities. And as a result of that, we formed an interagency team. And that interagency team has just done a marvelous job of doing train the trainers and providing tools locally to communities so that they had specific kinds of things that they could do that they knew worked. And that has been one of the most successful pieces of our interagency partnership. But we see cultural competency as the screen through which we look at everything it is that we do. So the plan development and implementation, The state commission office at the state level facilitates a group, an interagency group, which is really quite large, to tell you the truth. And then local commissions facilitate processes with both the public and private partners, both formal and informal, in their communities, again, to see what those communities need, to mobilize those communities around things that are important to that community, and then to provide us information as to what it is we really do need to advocate for. And then the last thing we do is resource development. Several biennia ago, we said it's really important for us to develop relationships with our private partners, and that's both foundations and corporations, so that we can again maximize our federal and state resources. We have a resource developer, and she has been very successful in especially helping local efforts to be able to garner additional funds and developing relationships with people like the Oregon Community Foundation, Wyoming Memorial Trust, Northwest Early Childhood Institute, corporations, other people that can, again, bring funding to different efforts. It's been especially important in the last two biennia when we have had such a reduction. And we're going to tell you more about that, because we're just about ready to announce a partnership with Oregon Community Foundation and eight other foundations to support the work of court-appointed special advocates. Moving on to this chart, which shows you all the agencies that are involved in, we call SB 555 actually Partners for Children and Families. And what we see as a major responsibility is we develop plan-based initiatives. Again, based upon the information from those local plans, we look at how we can address those issues in a multi-agency way. Break down barriers. If we as agencies have certain things that we're doing or not doing, what is it we need to change, again, to better support people in local communities? And then align our resources. Is there a way that we are able, for maximum impact, align our agents or our resources within our agencies to really address an issue? All right, primary responsibilities of local commissions. Again, advising the Board of County Commissioners around policies, especially as it relates to their work with mobilizing that community. Again, the community mobilization piece is huge. And Senator Gordley, you spoke to some of the ways in which we're working with the faith community and the private sector. Marion County, their local commission, a little over a year ago, knew that because of the meth epidemic, they had a terrible problem. And they said the problem had to do with not enough foster care homes. So they engaged the faith community, the Salem Leadership Foundation, which is a network of 162 churches. They said, we need at least 75 new foster care homes. They got them. Those homes were certified. Those people were trained. Now they are continuing as foster care parents. However, just a couple of months ago, which is a little more than a year, that same group of people came together and said, because of the problem in Marion County, we now need 250 new foster care homes. They have business people on their local community who have actually said, we will put up so much money if you will put up so much money. So they are trying to leverage the resources within the community, again, to wrap around that issue. I can't tell you today, but I will when we get to our Ways and Means hearing, where they're at in terms of getting those homes. I'll continue on. I won't go into the State Commission. They coordinate the development of those local plans. They develop policy and oversee the implementation. They monitor and evaluate the results. We have a very good system of getting data from local communities, organizing that data so we can see exactly what the outcomes for both our concrete programs like Healthy Start Relief Nurseries and CASA and those locally invested funds. And what each of you will have is you will have something for each of your counties in terms of where those funds are spent, what the success rates are, what the population is, how many were served, and what particular grant stream funded those particular pieces. And then they manage their resources again. There are accountability issues around evidence-based practices, making sure that they have contracts that are in place that get them the kind of information that they need. So I've talked a little bit about our primary programs. Healthy Start, home visitation, but the main objective of Healthy Start is to reduce child abuse and neglect. Relief nurseries. Child and abuse neglect information through strengthening parents, wrapping services around that family. And most of their services are done within a therapeutic classroom, but within one location. They do a lot of referral. They do respite care. They refer to employment training, alcohol and drug issues, etc. But they do a wonderful job of keeping those children who are at very, very high risk from entering the foster care system. And where they have the most important thing is to reunify them, if they can, with their family of origin, or to make sure that they still continue those services in some kind of permanent residency. Court-appointed special advocates, again, this is, right now we have funding to only serve 30% of those children who are eligible for a CASA. We have both federal and state mandates that say every child should have a CASA who is looking at the best interests of that child, either helping them to stay within or return to their family of origin, or helping to see that they have a permanent home.
Madam Chair,
go ahead.
If I may inquire about the federal and the state mandate around CASA. Given that we are not living up to our responsibility in providing the adequate level of funding, what are we liable in any legal way? Help me understand.
Chair,
I want to share something with
you. Yes, and members of the committee. This is a sensitive area. While there is a mandate to provide a CASA to every child, we are able at this point to have resources available to the point that federal funds that we get are not as yet in jeopardy, but we are just at the edge. And what I'd like to do is get more information for you so I can tell you specifically. But what I know is that's an issue that we have kept in our mind as we've moved ahead, and it's one of the reasons why we have worked so hard with the private community to garner additional funding for that program to make sure that none of our other funds are in jeopardy.
That's the question. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
An early childhood system to try and ensure that every community has an early childhood team that is really looking at those early childhood pieces that need to be in place for healthy development, juvenile crime prevention, to reduce juvenile arrests, to reduce risk factors of juveniles, again, to keep them from penetrating into the system. Positive youth development. There is an emphasis on making sure as much as we can that youth are a full participant in everything that we do and that we embed both policy and practice in what we do at the state level and hopefully at the local level to make sure those principles of positive youth development are there. Community schools, this is a fairly new initiative for us at the state level, but it is a way for accessing all kids and families and wrapping those social supports around that school. That is a very accessible place where families can access needed services, whether it be immunizations, whether it be mental health, whether it be alcohol and drug issues, clinics,
health clinics is just one of the most needed things we have in this particular state, and has been one of the most successful. But what we know is that when you have both enrichment programs and services for families at a school location, you have less absenteeism, especially as it relates to youth of color and for kids who live in poverty. You are able to access services there that otherwise they would have to go to many different locations to be able to access. So community schools is one of our new initiatives that we're really trying to work with the education community. And then the homeless and runaway population, you're going to hear more about this, but we've been coordinating statewide planning for the homeless and runaway population. Any questions about that?
No questions?
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm just going to move on to our funding streams. Policy and program support for both at the state level and local commissions, for children, family, staff, overhead, assisting with the development and implementation of those local plans. Great Start. Great Start was a funding stream that began in 1989. That's because 36 out of the 36 counties that brought plans to the state said, we need services in early childhood. The state spends most of their money on that older end, and what we need to do is have a flexible funding stream where we locally can look at that 0 to 6 population. It's now 0 to 8. Children, youth, and families, again, locally invested dollars, flexible, 0 to 18. And both of these funding streams are based upon, you have to fund programs based upon research and evidence-based practice. But for communities to decide locally how they want to use those funds. Child Care Development Fund, that is for child care, 0 to 13 years of age. We give grants to, again, those local communities to decide how it is they can use those funds, especially as it has to do with the quality of child care and the supply of child care in their local communities. Safe and Stable Families was originally called Family Preservation and Support, to keep children together with their families or help reunite them. Those are the parameters around that fund. Youth Investment, that's Title 20 dollars that come to us through Department of Human Services for youth who are acting out and at risk of abuse or neglect but are non-delinquent. Again, to keep those youth from going in further to the system. Healthy Start, Family Support Services, Relief Nurseries, and Court-Appointed Special Advocates. Those are all our funding streams.
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The Child Care Development Funds, are those funds outside of the Employment Department Child Care Program? It's two separate funding streams, is that?
Chair Boone and Senator Gordley, it comes from the same federal funding stream. There are three agencies that have child care dollars: Department of Human Services, the Child Care Division through the Employment Department, and the Commission on Children and Families, each with a different focus area.
And then one additional question, if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The governor's budget has $1 million for the court-appointed special advocates program. I believe you said that we're currently able to serve 30% of the children. What will $1 million provide?
Chair Boone, Senator Gordley, I'm going to have to get back to you with that information. We'll provide that for you at our hearing, or we can do that sooner if you'd like.
Okay. Senator Bates?
No, Madam Chair, thank you. Hi, here we go again. Nice to see you. I'll be looking and asking for information primarily on outcomes. We want to be able to see in these massive programs and the overlay programs of drug and alcohol treatment from a different agency, Head Start programs from a different agency, what you're doing with a different agency, how we're impacting families at risk. And there are so many agencies involved and so much overlap and so much difficulty in coordinating these efforts. Our question is, are we getting there? Is this the right model? Are we doing the right thing? I'll be especially interested in seeing what local communities are doing. And I'd like to have those outcomes broken out, if we can, by minority groups. Because I think the impact in some areas is different than others. Inner city Portland may be different than a Latino population or a population in my part of the state. And if you can break those figures out, that would be helpful to me. And I'm most interested in a conversation about what those outcomes are and how you go about measuring them, especially in a longitudinally long time, not 2 or 3 years or 1 or 2 years, but where we're at 10, 15 years later with these families that we've tried to reunite or try to put back together and try to maintain.
Chair Boone, Senator Bates, we will do the best we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That would be very good information for all of us, I think. Thanks for asking.
Madam Chair.
Just 1 second. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like I did in the last group, hi, Mickey. It's good to see you. I have a list of things for your next presentation. I'd like a history of Level 7 funding and how we're doing or not doing. I'd like a detailed summary of how the child care development funds are being spent to increase access. I know you've been doing a lot of work in the counties. I'd love to see a summary of those efforts. On the community schools initiative, again, a funding history and how we're doing. You know, I've been really involved with school-based work, and I'm trying to get my head around where that initiative is going. So additional information would be great. And then if we could you do a chart showing general fund versus federal fund on your funding streams? I'm always still confused which are general, which are federal. Are they in statute? Because they have different names and different, so some kind of table form would be helpful for me. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm interested in the Healthy Start program and if there are any longitudinal studies based on parents who have been helped, who don't have the parenting skills because they perhaps came from, you know, a history of dysfunctional families and so on. It's, I think, the first great intervention that we do, and I'm curious about if we track the results of our efforts. I don't need that now.
Chairwoman and Senator Morissette, we will get the information we have available for you. I will tell you, we do not have longitudinal studies on most things. We have trends. We have outcomes over time, but we will do the best we can with what we have, and we will have our Healthy Start evaluator be part of our presentation so that you can know more about that.
And I have a question along those same lines too. Is there any efforts in terms of long-term studies or tracking of some of your clients and the caseloads so that you can go in the future when these children do grow up, you can, I don't mean to tag or anything, but to pay attention to and offer them additional assistance if they need it, because they might need it still.
Chair Boone, we don't have as much of that kind of information that we would like, but we will get to you what we do have.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking that might be a good graduate student project. So are you finished, or you have more?
I'm going through our system performance measures. So, of course, as all of you know, every agency has key performance measures. And we have 5. Healthy Start, the incident rate for child maltreatment for children in the Healthy Start program. Local success outcomes. So it's the number of counties where their locally invested funds, the percentage of those funds, meet their expected targeted outcomes. Leveraged resources. What are our leveraged resources? Juvenile crime prevention, what is the percent of at-risk served in the juvenile crime prevention programs where their risk factors have decreased? And then customer satisfaction, the percent of customers rating their satisfaction with the agency's service as good or excellent. So those are the 5 key performance measures that you're going to hear about when we have our budget presentation.
Excuse me, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. A quick follow-up with regard to leveraged resources. You may have already planned to let us know. This particular performance measure is the amount of leveraged funds reported. Will you also be telling us about any funds that you might have had available but you had to leave behind unclaimed because we didn't have the matching funds? In other words, the leverage funds maybe we should have been able to take advantage of.
Okay. Chair Boone and Representative Nathanson, I'm not sure, but I will ask that question.
Thank you.
So if we can, we will.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And then last but not least, is you will see a roadmap for our performance measures and our reporting. And what you will have is, again, you will have county by county a look at where those counties are spending their money, what kind of outcomes they're getting, and how it rolls up to the high-level outcomes, you know, that we have as of Oregon Shines, but the focus area. We have about this much of the kid and family dollars in the Commission on Children and Families. And when you look at how those dollars are invested locally, it sometimes is difficult to see, are we really making a great impact in particular areas? What we know is that the Commission system, their particular dollars really are focused in three areas. The percent that improve family functioning, and that has to do with child abuse and neglect prevention. The percent that improve early childhood care and education, and then the percent that improves school success. Those are the three focus areas that you will be seeing in terms of each particular county and how they roll up to a state level in terms of impacting those particular things. The last thing that I'm going to talk about is Partners for Children and Families, the interagency group that coordinates, that Senator Bates, I know you're interested in. I want to tell you that there are five areas that you can see in this sheet. There are five initiatives that we are working in an interagency way to address some of these issues. Now, I will say to you, in 1999, when Senate Bill 555 passed, the whole goal was to get the information from local communities. That state group would take that information. They would decide what kind of issues or initiatives, the one, two, or three that they wanted to address, and then go ahead and address them. Well, that bill was passed in 99. In 2001, the legislature said, now you have to focus on an early childhood system and build policy and implement an early childhood statewide. Also in 2001, they said that you as agencies and several agencies need to develop and implement community schools all over the state. And then in 2005, you said you need to look at the homeless and runaway population and see, make recommendations back to us is what kind of a system can be created in order to make sure that we're serving those kids. We had not as yet chosen initiatives based upon the information from the local plans, but we have now. And we have two. First one was chosen earlier in the year to look at TANF families. What happens is that the children and families coming into the child welfare system, 30 to 36% of them are TANF families. So what we're looking at is an initiative that we can do in a multi-agency way that wraps services around those families to keep them out of the child welfare system. The second thing we're doing is reconnecting families. And it's an issue around children who are, or youth, who are aging out of the foster care system, 16 years of age and older, and be able to connect those youth with a relative, with family. 25% of kids who age out of the foster care system become homeless. 25%. And so what we're trying to do is we have developed a training, a six-month-long training with an expert by the name of Kevin Campbell, who has a methodology in which you can find family for these youth. We have 15 counties participating in a training whereby they have two to three, each one of them youth, that they are trying to find family for and connect these youth with family prior to these youth aging out of the foster care system. So they have a reliable, stable support system when they do that. Our hope, the State Commission also has taken that information from the local plans and said, number one, we need to change the policy in the state so that we can reimburse families who are relatives of foster care children. And number two, we need to pay them a decent sum in order to do that. Because essentially the policy now is that we force children to be placed with strangers if we do not pay relatives for foster care. We're also looking at the foster care system in terms of how does the community better support foster care parents so that people really do want to provide foster care to these kids that need it so badly. Dr. Catherine Kahn from PSU Child Welfare Partnership wrote a briefing paper for us, and we thought as a system the issue was the lack of foster care. But what Dr. Kahn said, it's not the lack of foster care. We'll never build our way out of this. We need to learn how to keep kids safe in their own homes. But if we can't, then they need to be placed with safe relatives. Further question.
Go ahead.
It's mind-boggling that a foster parent would produce a homeless child. I mean, I guess it's a comment that we don't have enough adequate foster parents and that we shove kids in places that they shouldn't be. Do you do a profile of foster parents after they've had a series of failures and keep giving them kids that are going to be homeless after they're through being in a foster home? I mean, I can't believe it.
Chair Boone, Senator Morissette, this is the figure when we began the training that the Department of Human Service used in terms of those kids that had been in the foster care system and then aged out in terms of 25% becoming homeless. We certainly can provide more information to you.
Madam Chair.
Hold on just one second. Go ahead, Susan.
Okay, the other comment I would make is that perhaps when Ramona Foley from Children, Adults, and Families of Department of Human Services can come up, they can talk more about what their independent living services does and doesn't do in terms of transitioning youth from foster care to independence.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would actually echo that we asked for some of that information from the department, from DHS, so when they come, they can explain some of the statistics and what is happening of children who are leaving the system for the streets and what their plans are around that. I think it's excellent the commissions have identified that, but it goes back to the system that is administered by the Department of Human Services.
Is this the Kevin Campbell from the east side of the state?
Chair Boone, no, it isn't.
Oh, it's not.
There are several Kevin Campbells.
There are. Yeah. Okay. The third one, then.
But the Campbells are coming.
The Campbells are coming in. Thank you very much. Very interesting food for thought, too, that last piece. Does anybody have any more questions?
Lots of them.
Well, I'd like to thank Nikki Lansing and Rocky King, although I think he's gone, for a wonderful overview. We will look forward to your in-depth information coming up soon. So without further ado, do you have any one announcement maybe about tomorrow? Go ahead, Sharon.
Madam Chair, not about tomorrow necessarily. The subcommittee does not meet tomorrow, but next week you will be taking up the Board of Medical Examiners and then the Board of Nursing's budgets. So you'll get no budget hearings.
Yeah, right, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's no full committee tomorrow. Is that right?
That's correct. Okay. I'm glad that you mentioned those two health licensing boards. If I may just
sure.
add a question to pass on to the chair and the co-chairs. It's always been curious to me that the health licensing boards are housed in the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee as opposed to being in the Human Services Subcommittee. And so if someone could come back with an answer that gives the rationale and talks about how that has been assigned historically, that would be very helpful to me.
Can we do that for us? Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair, just very quickly, I think primarily it's an issue of workload, given the depth and breadth of the Department of Human Services particularly, but some of the other agencies. I think that it was felt that that evens out the workload between the two subcommittees. But I will check to see if it was more than that.
Thank you, Sheila. And Representative Gerard has the last question.
Actually, it's not a question, Madam
last,
Chair. Just
the last
a,
word.
Just a comment in that as a county commissioner, I had the opportunity of being a liaison to the children and families, and we had the unfortunate problem of having to replace our director at that time because it didn't meet the high standards that this agency has. And Mickey, I know I publicly thanked you 100 times, but their involvement, their leadership, and just reiterated to me the commitment by this agency at the local level. So I just like to give a star next to your name wherever I see your name. So thank you again.
Yes, thank you. There being no further business before this committee, we will adjourn.